Hello and welcome to Book Talk. I'm Paul Gallagher, and our book under discussion in this edition of the show is The Goldfinch, the third novel from Donna Tartt, the best-selling American author of The Secret History and The Little Friend. Published at the end of 2013, The Goldfinch ended up on pretty much every major publication's Best of the Year list, and earlier this year was awarded the Pulitzer Prize for Fiction. Joining me now to help answer the question, it's Tartt, but is it art? Our Scottish Book Trust Head of Reader Development, Philippa Cochrane, and journalist, broadcaster, and reader-in-residence, Jane Graham. So, recently published in paperback, The Goldfinch is a hefty tome of a novel telling the story of Theo Decker, a 13-year-old New Yorker whose life is literally blown apart one morning when a bomb goes off in the art gallery that he and his mother are browsing in. His mother is killed in the explosion, a loss whose profound impact Tartt charts through the course of the novel. But Theo is relatively unharmed, physically at least, and as he wakes in the aftermath of the explosion, he has another life-altering encounter with an old man who hands Theo a signet ring and points to a small painting on the wall, the Goldfinch of the title, before dying of his injuries. Theo takes the painting and the ring, and the latter leads him to an out-of-the-way antique store where he finds Hobie, a specialist in antique furniture and one of a number of key characters in the intricate, dense story that Tartt proceeds to unfold. So, Philippa, Donna Tartt takes her time writing her novels. There were 10 years between her debut, The Secret History, and the follow-up, The Little Friend, and it's been a further 11 years that fans have been waiting for The Goldfinch. So my first question is, was that 11 years well spent?
Oh, that's very difficult to answer, because I am in two minds about this book. There were bits of it that absolutely gripped me and that are some of the best writing I have read in years. And there were bits of it that just went on and on and on. But I think that's very deliberate on her part. And I think that's what she's trying to do. And that kind of schizophrenic nature of the way the book is constructed is at the heart of what it's about. Reality versus fantasy. It's to do with show and versus tell. All of this is wrapped up in it for me. And consequently, although there were bits of it I found incredibly frustrating because they went on for such a long time, I don't think you can just dismiss them out of hand, because I think that's part of what she's trying to do.
Jane, just for a general sort of impression from you then, and is it a work that feels that it's had that effort put into it?
11 years is a very long time to spend writing a book, so you kind of think, all right, well, if you're going to take that long, it's got to be a masterpiece, and it's not a masterpiece. It's interesting what Philip was saying about that contrast. Is this deliberate? Do we go from, you know, this environment in New York, which is so embracing and warm and lovely, to just wallow in all these lovely oranges and browns and the love of, you know, between the mother and the son and the old furniture shop that he ends up in, and into the cold, steely blues of Vegas. And for me personally, I was just desperate to get back to New York.
I totally agree with you. You can visualise this book, particularly those first two sections. I think there's such a sort of palpable sadness.
Yeah.
The fact that that loss is so recent, you feel it in the writing and you feel it. And that's a really powerful section. We won't talk too much about plot, but, you know, Theo has to leave New York and go to be with his father, who has previously not been on the scene in Vegas, and then makes friends with this guy, Boris, who becomes perhaps the most memorable character in the book.
He's one of the clearest signals towards Dickens that you find anywhere. I mean, he is the Artful Dodger. He's the Artful Dodger ripped into the 21st century and given access to all sorts of stuff.
And in fact, just like you were saying, Tartt likes to tell us, doesn't one of the characters in the book talk about him as the Artful Dodger? Hobie says, I always imagined him as that actor who played the Artful Dodger.
Yeah, he's the character that I felt most connected with throughout the whole thing. He was the character that I was thinking, I want to spend more time in your company, even though you're obviously mad, bad, and dangerous to know. At the same time, he is completely unrealistic and fantastical. And I think he's the biggest signal that there's a very conscious thing at play here between of the tensions between those, that kind of the serious American novel and the children's book, the coming of age teen drama, and all of the lightness and magicalness that that can encapsulate. I think Boris kind of inhabits both of those spaces in a way that the other characters, I think the other characters in the book are kind of split across those different aspects. Boris is the link, Boris is the bridge, and consequently he is actually more vibrant than anything else that's going on in that book, for me.
That tension there between sort of reality and then this more kind of fictionalized, imaginative world. And obviously, the nature of art and what art does is a big concern of Donna Tartt's here. The Goldfinch itself, this painting which represents so much to Theo, there's a little passage about it, a character called Horst, who talks about art taking on a deeper sort of beauty, the illusion of reality that is broken down into its elements. And he sees it in the painting of the Goldfinch, saying that is the thing, and yet not the thing. Mm-hmm. And it seems to be one of those moments which pop up sporadically in the book of Tartt sort of really focusing in on these are the important words here. This is what this is all about.
Exactly that passage for me crystallized all of the things that I was sort of really struggling to figure out as I was reading through this book. I was going, what is she doing?
Yeah.
That's what she's doing.
You know, I mean, it's interesting what you're saying, because it's that she keeps convinced this idea that there is reality, and as she puts it, then there's this blurred space between reality and where the mind meets reality. And she says that is where beauty resides, mm-hmm. that's where art resides, that's where love resides. And that is it. It's really the only place it's worth living in, because life is catastrophe. But she's obsessed with this idea. And it's why I think some characters like Boris, as you say, he's a kind of a cipher for what she's trying to say. Mm-hmm. And in that sense, that's why he's not completely ensconced in reality, because he has to symbolise so many things. And increasingly, as the book goes on, the weight of his symbolism weighs him down, and he comes out at the end with a speech, with these speeches that you think that doesn't quite sound like Boris. He's suddenly very articulate and very artistic and eloquent, and he's talking about art while he's telling us, I don't know nothing about art, but this is what I do know. And then he kind of explains the entire philosophy of the book, which is it God? Is it something else? Is it art that brings us together, that lets us communicate from century to century? And in that case, is art more important than people?
That's right. And it's him who first voices this idea that perhaps actually doing good things is not the way to get to sort of the meaning of life. It is the kind of theory of the book, and he's the one who has to shoulder the theorizing until the very end of the book, where Donna Tartt basically pushes any pretense of anything else aside and goes, here's a few pages for me just to explain.
The point you're making there about morality, and sometimes you do bad things and good things happen, and she's very, in case you don't get it again, she refers to Dostoevsky and The Idiot. You know, bad things happen to good things happen to bad people, and The Idiot, you have this kind of this kid who's really full of good intentions, full of heart and trust, and yet continually draws a darkness to him. And you know, Theo's in despair at this, and he says, what is the message? You know, don't be good, don't bother, there's something bigger than you at work, and the best you can do is do what Boris does, because Boris ultimately is the happiest person in the book as well, because he's an agent of chaos. He doesn't mind being an agent of chaos. He kind of says, bring it on, I'll surf the wave of madness while everyone else is struggling to control.
The family I found really interesting with the Barbers. You've got a mother who's very constrained by the society rules in which she lives, or comes across that way, and seems to be quite cold and standoffish, and yet is very welcoming and takes this lost child into her home. You've got a father who has a history of mental health issues, and then you've got four children, one of whom is sort of possibly slightly dodgy but quite attractive and charismatic teenage boy, and who enjoys terrorizing his younger brother, who's much more academic. The academic younger brother, who is in some respects a complete stereotype of what a child like that might be, but also has a lot of heart as a friend in some respects.
I liked Andy as well.
But there were times where I was kind of going, oh yeah, of course he'd be into that. And then two younger children again, a younger sister and a younger brother, just sort of running around in the background, being slightly chaotic. And then when they come back into the story later on, they have lost family members, and the whole structure of that family has been pulled apart. And you start to understand that the bonds that tied them were much stronger than they realise, and were much stronger than they first appeared. And that particularly the mother, I thought Mrs. Barber was particularly affecting, in that always throughout the earlier parts of the novel, she is this strong being who's moving through it, and who cannot be knocked off course, and who cannot be affected or brought low by anything. And then you see her at the end of the novel as the person that people are most concerned with taking care of, like stopped dead in her tracks by what life has thrown at her. And I found her really moving.
I felt she was also, in a way, though, Donna Tartt's solitary tale, because she was a woman who was very much in control of her life, wasn't she? And lives in this house that's very well ordered and has all this beautifully chosen furniture and is the opposite of the chaotic kind of furniture shop that Theo lives in with. It almost becomes this kind of foster father hobby. And so she's, unlike Boris, she's so ill-prepared for a random event which just blows her life open, and she can't ride it. She's completely broken by it and has never recovers. And it's, and it's funny because at first you don't imagine that you're going to warm to her. And then towards the end when you see how broken she is. And that Theo is very surprised when he realises himself, when he is, he's going to, you know, kind of undervalue his own life and maybe hurt people and upset people along the way by behaving in a kind of self-destructive way. She's the one he can't do it to.
Yeah. Yeah.
Although there are other people who've clearly loved him more and looked after him. Her vulnerability for him, I think, makes it, he just can't, he couldn't forgive himself if he just struck one more blow, I think, in her
but I think
direction.
She's also the one who unquestionably stood by him at that very point when he needed her. She did not waver. I'm getting quite emotional thinking about this. It's quite weird. I hadn't realised how much it affected. She did, you know, in her very uptight, level way, she did not waver. She did not question. And she stopped people treating Theo badly. Hobie provides him support, but he doesn't ever step in the way that Mrs. Barber steps in. I really loved her for that.
It's interesting, right, though, because she is the one element of unpredictable chaos that she allows into her very ordered life. Mm. And oddly, it's almost the thing that pays back the most, which is a very interesting, and is again all part of the pattern, isn't it?
And we've been vaguely touching on the fact that through this novel, there are these, and Philippa, you referred to this previous to the discussion, but there are these kind of explosions that the story is marked by. And Theo, but other characters as well, but Theo in particular, he's sort of at the whim of fate, isn't he? He doesn't do a lot. There was one moment towards the end where I thought, he's made a decision.
But I was thinking about the analogies with Harry Potter.
There's a lot of references to Harry Potter. He gets called Potter by Boris, and then there are various other. Theo goes, oh yeah, remember those movies? He talks about parcel tongue in one, the snake language in Harry Potter.
For me, the analogy there is this thing about agency. A lot of, you know, the whole thing about Harry Potter being his life is predestined by what happened to him as a child.
It's passive, but it's also that Dickensian thing, isn't it? About coincidence. You need a kind of a passive Pip character that things will happen to. And actually, I think that becomes almost the point of the whole novel and the point of the way that she sees the way you have to negotiate life and why we need art to make sense of things, to give things some kind of a pattern and a point. And she has got quite an old-fashioned, and you could almost say a childish idealisation of beauty and art, and she specifically mentions magic as well, kind of going back to that Harry Potter. She doesn't want, I think, wholeheartedly to move away from Theo as a child. His voice as a child is the most convincing and the strongest, and that she doesn't quite let it go as the book goes on. And in the end, when she's kind of summarising this is what it's about, I feel the child of Theo and the way children see the world is still very much a part of her vision. Mm. She does kind of idealise childish visions of the world, but she would see it as a kind of heightening of the senses.
It's making everything brighter, it's making everything more of what it is, so that when you're looking at the artistic elements, the construct of the goldfinch, or the construct of Hobie's furniture, that you're seeing it for more than it is. You're appreciating all that it carries with it as well.
Right, yeah, so with this element of Hobie's furniture, which is put together out of bits and pieces, and then in one of the plot lines, Theo sells some of it as if it is the real antique stuff, and it fools people. In that same way, this novel itself, Donata, is sort of putting together an amalgam, a mash that fools us.
Well, I think she's kind of saying it doesn't matter. The idea of what's truthful and real changes from person to person. I mean, she does increasingly hammer home this idea. No one sees anything the same way. Mm. It's impossible to share any kind of a vision at all. We all see different things. Mm. And she kind of says, well, that's how it has to be. As long as you're truthful to the voice that you hear in your head. We all bring different experiences, all kinds of different places that we've travelled, other books we've read, other families that we've been in. And there's no such thing as the truth, and there's no such thing as the better piece of furniture. We all kind of cobble things together and create our own version of truth and reality. But I also think there are, when she does write well, you do think, damn it, I just could never have written that. Yeah. And some of it's really simple stuff, like when he goes to Amsterdam and she describes it as a breathable glitter. And I just thought, what a brilliant phrase that is. There's another bit where he says his heart's buzzing around like a bee under a jar. And I thought instantly I could feel the heart in my breast. And there's a little bit picked out that he's describing Holby's room. And he says, it's a world of ticking clocks and creaking floorboards, pots and baskets of turnips and onions in the kitchen, candle flames leaning all to the left in the draft of an open door, and tall parlour windows billowing and swagged like ball gowns, cool quiet rooms where old things slept. And you just think, it's like a big duvet going around you. And that's when you get to Vegas, you think, I want to go back there.
Yeah.
I do think there's an issue, though, with the role that women play in the novel, potentially, when you start unpicking it and looking at it, and they're either idealised, like his mother and Pippa.
But you're right, she is this idealised figure in his mind. She is always there as the, but if only I could have Pippa.
But I don't think that's necessarily a bad thing. I think many of us do have idealised people in our life that we perhaps came at a particular time and we moved on from, but we kind of see as the lost soulmate or the lost first love, or maybe the lost family member who we didn't, you know, we wish we could go back and say things to. Because you also were very moved by Mrs. Barber as a female character who changed and developed, and you became quite emotional just thinking about her.
But for me, she is the only female character who changed and developed.
But not that many characters in general. Well,
and I think that's an interesting thing, and I don't think Theo changes and develops, and that's what makes it so tricky to talk about, because I do have issues with some of the women in the book. There's not much complexity to them.
But that could be Theo's failings rather than hers.
Again, there's this problem of, well, but at the end of the day, it's all an intentional creation, because as we know, this is all written by Theo and explicitly tells us at the end how he wrote it and what it is. And Jane, like you were saying, the idea that no two people can see a piece of work in the same way. Similarly, Theo's representation of these, inverted commas, real people is clearly not the real thing, the thing itself. And again, it's another get out clause.
I think that to come back to Boris, I think that's why Boris is such a vibrant and interesting character, is because Theo cannot make his mind up about Boris.
Yeah.
And Boris, you know, his reaction to Boris is so complicated, and Boris is the best friend he's ever had, but he's also obviously leading him into some terrible situations, and has the dodgiest morals of anyone you've ever come with. But it's fun and vibrant, and, you know,
some of those conversations where he comes to him and he says, so I've done this thing for you. Isn't it the best thing ever? And you're just like, where did this come from?
Again, still sounds a bit like a child. That childishness of their relationship never really grows up, does it? Yeah, that's true.
And I think that is the thing. I think, actually, you are right. I think it's not just that the female characters don't develop. It's that pretty much none of the characters develop.
Okay, we've talked around a lot of things, and we could talk for much longer, but we do need to kind of come to a conclusion. And so let's get to Donna Tartt's conclusion by way of conclusion, because I'd like to ask you guys. She offers a very, we've talked about it a bit already, she offers a very clear final reflection and summing up on all that we've read. She kind of uses the voice of Theo to give us, say, 10 pages of reflection on what this story was all about, basically, what it all means. She finishes telling the story, and then she tells us what we should take from it. I'm not entirely sure that that's a great thing.
I found the ending frustrating. I found reading it frustrating, because I'm going, I got it. No, really, I got this. At the same time, I think I have to acknowledge that she is too good a writer to have put something in that is going to irritate people without having done so for a reason.
We know almost nothing about Donna Tartt. She's very, very private. We know very little. But what she does do when she gives interviews is talk about the great writers that she loves. And I think she is very keen to be regarded in the same light as. And I think for me, a lot of that ending was her attempting to position herself alongside the people that she values most highly. And Nabokov does it in Lolita, and he actually comes to the same kind of conclusion where he says, because here's a character that has been idealised totally out of recognition, and you, as the book goes on, you realise this character, Lolita, is not even her name, and it's got nothing to do with the person she is in real life. And he kind of finally admits that, and he says, well, the only immortality we have is through art, is the same immortality that orcs and angels share, and it's through art. And I think she, I know she's a big Nabokov fan. I think she goes around saying that she's the exact same height as Lolita. She's a tiny wee thing. And she talks about Dostoevsky does it quite a lot as well. He likes to present these little summaries, and I think she's trying to position herself somewhere that she would really like to be, and she's maybe not quite got the skill, or in fact the madness that someone like Dostoevsky has, because there is a kind of crazy madness to the way that he writes, and he flies off in different directions, and he says, oh, hang on, I must collect myself. She's much more controlled than that, but to me it's a slight way of saying, please put me next to these guys.
Yeah, it's not like she has no grounds to make that claim. You know, like, it grates that she is drawing attention to how good she is. It doesn't take away from the fact that she is really good.
Yes, that's very interesting,
For me, that final reflection on kind of the deathless nature of art and the fact that if we connect our lives with art, then we somehow connect to an immortal soul and connect to people who have died, who are connected with it. I found it in the final moments quite poignant, but I found that there was an earlier moment, I'm just going to read this little quote, when he looks at the goldfinch and he sees it again for the first time in ages, which really captured that I was different, but it wasn't. And as the light flickered over it in bands, I had the queasy sense of my own life in comparison as a patternless and transient burst of energy, a fizz of biological static, just as random as the street lamps flashing by. And in that moment, I was like, wow, yeah, that's, I've seen it. I've seen what she's doing. So then when she told me again at the end, I was a bit like,
oh, just leave us with that. That's fantastic. Don't tell us what that meant. Mm-hmm. Let us, even if we get it wrong, you yourself are saying it's okay to get it wrong. Yeah. It's okay to interpret that differently.
It does feel very controlling as an experience, yes, doesn't
that's
it?
Right, it's
interesting, isn't it? Because like you were saying, Jane, again, to come back to that point, the book is absolutely about how no two people can look at a piece of art in the same way. Mm-hmm. And yet, Donna Tartt seems to want everyone to look at this piece of art, her book, The Goldfinch, in a particular way. There is clearly a lot more that we could say about The Goldfinch. I think we've done well. We've got into it pretty well today, and I'm sure we could further. But for now, we'll tie up our discussion there. But I think we all agree The Goldfinch is a book that is definitely worth talking about, worth reading. It's an effort to read, but we would all agree that it is worth reading.
Yes, it is definitely worth reading.
And I think it's also worth reading, not just in the point of the book itself, but I think you'll come back to it when you read other books. Mm-hmm. And books about America, and books about New York, and books about from a female writer writing a book. But lots of different ways it will feed into the next book you read, and a book and other books that you read. And in a sense, that Oblis, she would be very into that idea, because she likes the idea that each thing feeds into the next, and art, you know, brings forth larger art, larger beauty, all that kind of thing.
Yeah, definitely. Well, if you've read The Goldfinch, we'd love to hear what you thought. Add your comments on our Book Talk webpage at scottishbooktrust.com, on Twitter at ScottishBKTrust, or at Facebook. And the next book we'll be discussing in a month's time on Book Talk will be More Than This, the latest novel for young adults by Patrick Ness. A change of pace from The Goldfinch, but an equally fascinating and interesting read. Before that, you can tune in for another interviews edition of Book Talk in 2 weeks' time. Thanks so much to my guests, Jane Graham and Philippa Cochrane. Always a pleasure to talk books with you. And for Book Talk, I'm Paul Gallagher. Goodbye.